Kanga Audio.
A quick thanks before we start the show. Filmmaking Confidential, the book, is now an Amazon.com and Audible.com bestseller. I just want to say thank you to all of you who ordered it and for your support. If you haven't yet picked it up and you want to learn my filmmaking secrets, Filmmaking Confidential is for you. It's available wherever books are sold in most countries around the world. Order by visiting Audible or Amazon. To find out more, check out filmmakingconfidential.com and stevebalderson.com. Thank you. I'm Steve Balderson, and you're listening to the Filmmaking Confidential podcast. In this podcast, we meet with filmmakers, writers, actors, artists, and other notables. Today's guest is filmmaker and author John Gaspard.
It's called Behind the Page, the Eli Marks podcast, because I have a series of 8 mystery novels about a magician named Eli Marks. The premise of the podcast is you tune in and you hear an interview with someone who can explain something about something that happened in that chapter, generally in a very broad sense, and then you listen to a chapter from the book. So the first season, which we just finished up, is you can listen to the entire first book in the series, The Ambitious Card, all 24 chapters, over the course of a year for free. You can listen to the book, and then you also have this added interview with someone who knows something a little more about the topic. And they're generally magicians or performers or people in the variety arts. And we're gearing up to do season 2, which will look at the second book in the series, The Bullet Catch, and take a fake. So it's a way of giving away the audiobook for free. But most people, at least what I've heard from listeners, is we love the interviews. I started listening to the book. I can't wait. I literally can't wait. I went out and bought the audiobook. So, which is fine. Or they can listen to it for free, either way.
Oh, that's great. I think that sounds really fun. Tell me more about these books.
Well, the Eli Marks Mystery Series is, what is it? It's a humorous, what's called cozy mystery. Cozy in the sense that all the violence pretty much happens off screen. There isn't really any swearing or much sex to speak of. And the detective is in a cozy, generally a regular person who's not, doesn't make their living as a detective. In this case, it's a magician named Eli Marks. He makes his living doing magic shows for corporations, trade shows, product reveals, birthday parties, walk around magic, that sort of thing. His uncle is a master magician who's been doing it for 70 some years. He's in his 80s and who knows everything about magic. Eli is a working stiff who knows kind of just enough to get along in his business. But he does keep kind of stumbling into crime situations where his way of looking at things, look, because magicians look at the world differently than average people, it proves to be helpful. And the police continually turn to him to, hey, we've had this murder here. This projectionist was killed in a film projection booth. It was locked from the inside. There's no way in, no way out. How did it happen? And that becomes the premise for the whole book. So there, it's a fun, light series. People seem to like it. Magicians have taken to it very, very kindly. I actually had a really nice email from Teller of Penn and Teller, who said he had read one of the books and said, most people, when they write about magicians, they don't get it right. And you got it right, which is really, really nice because I'm not a magician. I just know enough to write about it more than the average person does.
At the end of my day, I love watching something on TV, right? And yeah. Typically, just for a little bit. And I am not so fond of heavy, dark. I mean, although I loved that the miniseries Hinterland, mm-hmm. you know, the series on that the BBC did, it was still really dark. I mean, these are just like messed up people and characters, but it was gorgeous and it was well done. And I loved it. But instead of that, because it's so heavy sometimes, I really love Midsummer Murders.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know that? Okay. And I think I have, maybe there's one episode that's new now, but I have seen every season, like seriously, all of them. Like I spent half of lockdown watching that entire show. And I like that sort of tone, you know,
You can just sink into it and it, you know you're not going to get hit over the head with something too dark or realistic.
Exactly. And it's
and they're clever. Fun. Yeah, they're clever.
Do you work with anybody to make it more complex, or how do you do it? Do you start with the solution and reverse engineer it, or
usually? Yeah, I'm not a puzzle person. I don't have that kind of mind. And so coming up with the mystery portion, particularly trying to make a mystery that's fair in the sense of not good, bad, fair, but fair in the sense of you feel like as a reader, when you get to the end, it's a surprise that is also inevitable. That for me, some people can just knock them off like crazy. There's a British writer named Anthony Horowitz who worked on Midsummer Murders and a lot of British mysteries, and his mind is just, he can do that sort of twisty thing. For me, I need to figure that out first, you know, who did it and why. And then you just sort of back into it from that. I also have a couple of good friends who are magicians who will come in and sort of just do a last pass check on the magic. You know, did you get that right? Only to the degree that if a magician read it, they'd go, oh, yeah, that's exactly what you'd have to do in that trick at that point for it to actually work. The average reader doesn't really care. And most of them seem to enjoy the fact that magic tricks are described but not revealed in it. But yeah, the mystery is the hardest part. And once I get that nailed down, then the rest of it's just, you know, character stuff. And that's always fun to write.
Are they mostly all whodunits, or do you have like some whydunits?
They're all whodunits to one degree or another. It's not like Columbo where you know from the beginning and you're working with him to try to figure out why they did it. No, it's very much in the Agatha Christie and then there were none format of you've got this number of people, each one of them had a motive of some kind, and you're just trying to knock off each one to go, okay, well, they didn't do it because of this, they didn't do it because of that. And as he learns more information, things become crystallized. And then there's always one. The nice thing about Eli Marks, as a reader pointed out to me, is he gets it wrong about as often as he gets it right. And by getting it wrong at the 4/5 of the way through the book mark, he puts himself in danger because he said, this is who the killer is. And then the actual killer is revealed and he goes, oh my goodness, I'm in trouble now because this person's going to kill me. And I didn't realize they were the killer. And that's the fun of writing Eli, is he is a flawed, funny guy. He is neurotic. He has panic attacks. He has guilt and self-doubt. And so he's not like Sherlock Holmes. He's just this poor schmuck who, for better or worse, has a weird way of looking at the world. And that can sometimes help the police.
Well, have you optioned them? Has anybody filmed something? Have you filmed something from them?
No, I have not. Even though you'd think I would, because I've made a bunch of feature films, and why not? But it's what you write for a book is a lot different than what I would write for a screenplay. And I would have to really tear a book apart to rewrite it in that form. Someone did try shopping around a little bit. A few years ago, I did recently make a kind of an animatic of one of the short stories. And if you want, I can send you a link for that. If you want to post that, it's kind of fun. It does introduce you to the character in a fun way. But I'm not really interested right now in well, I would love for someone to make a series out of it. Personally, I just don't want to, you know, put that on my back and shoulder the, okay, I've got to cast this properly. I've got to write it properly. I've got to get a magic store set. But, you know, it... Once you've learned what production entails, you're less likely to dive into it without understanding that you're getting yourself into a year of stuff.
Of course. Well, I always thought then sometimes, because I've written also and, you know, even made some music. And sometimes as an artist, something comes out and it's clear as day meant to be a movie or something visually moving. Right, like that moves. And Sometimes it's not meant to be that. Sometimes it's meant to just be a book.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think that Eli Marks should make a great limited series where, you know, season one is the first book and it's 6 episodes. Magic can be very visual and really fun. And with shows like Penn and Teller Fool Us, people have a great appreciation of when it's done well, and also they're less likely to go, oh, that's CGI. there's a certain amount of magic tricks in the book, but I try not to overload it because describing magic is much different than seeing magic. But I do think that the character in his situations would make a great cable series. I just don't have the resources to make that happen.
How long are the books typically?
Oh, boy. They run generally 250 to 300 pages, around 70,000 words.
Do you have audio versions?
I do. I have every one of them is in an audiobook. If you want, I can send you links. If you want, if you like audiobooks,
that's the only way I really consume books.
Mm-hmm. No, I love audiobooks, and it's one of the things that one of the few things now that I'm retired that I miss about having a job to go to every day was listening to audiobooks in the car. But I'm very lucky because the guy who kind of got me interested in writing this was I used to be in meetings and events in video production for corporate America. And one of the guys I met in that, who was an MC for us at a number of events, has an interest in magic. And because of him, I became interested in magic. And because of him, I wrote the series. And because he's a professional voice talent, he said, you know what, why don't we do the audiobooks? And to hear him interpret what I've written is far better, I think, than reading what I've written. He's just such a good narrator. So I always try to steer people toward the audiobooks because I think it's a better experience. I'll send you some links and you can see if you like them.
Are they on Audible?
They are on Audible.
My first audiobook was on tape, and it was Jodie Foster narrating Contact. And this was, you know, I was at CalArts. It was 94, 5, or 6. I don't remember when it was. And it was something that I listened to driving from CalArts back to Kansas for one of the semester breaks or something. Mm-hmm. I just fell in love with the idea because it was sort of like you could let it play. And then as a visual person, you know, you can imagine the scene. You can see the movie or the scene in your mind however you want, you know, instead of being, you know, told it or whatever. And so I really, really love them. I also love them while I'm making dinner. You know, I can put them on in the background and it just sort of is a nice sort of thing to relax the mind from the day.
Absolutely. If you could get a narrator, I mean, listened to books simply by following the narrator from book to book, where I didn't really care about the author, but the narrator was so strong.
Did you hear the Harry Potter audiobooks?
Yes, I heard the Jim Dale versions, not the Stephen Fry versions.
Yeah, I heard the Jim Dale versions also. He's incredible, that guy.
Yeah, and I don't know how many characters is it, like 700 characters. It's some ridiculous number that he kept track of.
And they each had a different sound and everything. Yep. I mean, he was so good. I have four characters. I have two. Well, no. I have two sounds for a male voice, two sounds for a female voice. I have a child's voice and an old person's voice. And that's about it.
That's about all you need. That's about all you need, really.
Yeah. I mean, because I love listening to them so much, I was asked to narrate a guy's audiobook, and I had never done that before. I don't consider myself an actor. I don't consider myself, you know, whatever. But I thought, sure, why not? You know, and I had a setup because I had done, you know, other just, you know, ADR type stuff for movies. And so I narrated this book and it was a total blast. And it was challenging and fun. And I didn't realize how much I enjoyed it. And then I was asked two or three other times to do somebody else's. And I thought, you know, this is kind of cool. And so I never considered it the idea of being a voiceover actor, but mm-hmm. I guess I am suddenly.
Yeah. Well, you have a great voice. Why not?
Well, thank you.
And you enjoy doing it, you know.
Totally. I mean, it's interesting. I was going to ask you if you had narrated yours, because when I narrated my Filmmaking Confidential book and then this new one, it's my own voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was very easy for me. I feel like it's a better listen than it is to read, because you can really hear what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But had you thought about narrating yours?
I had not. And probably because the idea of even doing an audiobook hadn't occurred to me until my friend, who's a professional voice talent, said we should do the audiobooks. So it made sense for him to do it. I have, you know, read some introduction stuff on some other books that I've written where the audio guy said the author should read the introduction. I'll do the rest of it, but you read the introduction. And didn't really enjoy the process. I've gotten better at listening to me, having now done 24 episodes of a podcast, and I can sort of separate who that is from who I am and just be annoyed at him and not at me for the things he does. But it's, you know, my wife is an actress and she's written a book and we've started her audiobook a couple times and she just finds it exhausting and doesn't enjoy it. I think there's a mindset that just either like it or you don't like it. It's a weird sort of a work.
It is. I mean, I like being productive. So even if it doesn't come to something, if I'm busy at it, if I'm being busy and I'm making or doing, yeah. I am happy. And then if it, you know, takes me hours and hours to edit, I feel so productive, you know, and then at the end of the day, I'm like, oh, thank God I got another, whatever it is done. And, you know, it doesn't really bother me. There are things that do, like, I don't go grocery shopping. I get all my groceries delivered, you know, or other just random things, you know, that I know other people enjoy, but, I understand what you mean. It's a total mindset. Speaking of mindsets, had you always wanted to make films?
Yes. I've always been in some form interested in making or telling stories. I realized this last Halloween when somewhere on Facebook, a sound effects album popped up that someone was excited about. And I'd had that album. And I remembered as a kid using that sound effects album to create some stories. I was lucky that at around age 11, and an uncle who had an old wind-up regular 8 film camera that he was done with, and he gave it to me. And I had enough money as a paperboy that I could start buying film and shooting stuff and getting the kids in the neighborhood to do stuff, and enjoyed that quite a bit. And then was again lucky in that I live here in Minneapolis, St. Paul. There was a program called Film in the Cities, which was an afternoon film program as part of what was called urban arts. There was dance and theater and all that, and then a film program, and you actually finished up your studies in high school in the morning, got on a bus and spent the afternoon at a building in downtown St. Paul making films, doing animations, shooting live action stuff, doing all that. And I did that for 3 years at a time when film was considered to be a good thing for self-expression. And so there was a lot of emphasis placed on self-expression and not a lot of emphasis placed on narrative storytelling or setting up shots or matching action or any of the stuff you would actually learn in a film school. But because I had all the tools, they had cameras and tons and tons and tons of film, I sort of just went off and did sort of story stuff. I ended up making, as a senior in high school, a feature-length Super 8 single-system sound movie, 80 minutes long, which at the time, one of the writers at Super 8 Filmmaker Magazine said, no one has ever done that at this time, single-system being a complete pain in the butt to work with. And then did another one the next year. And just I've over the years, just sort of graduated from regular 8 to Super 8 to Super 8 sound to shooting on 3/4-inch video in college to moving to 16mm features a few years after that. And then digital came around. And the last few things I've done have all been in digital and have generally either written or co-written everything and produced it and generally edited everything. And as we were talking about, you know, it's a task-oriented sort of focus. It's fun to just go from this idea you have to a script, to seeing actors do it, to shooting it, to editing it and refining it. It's something I've just been doing for 60-some years.
I often wonder about this with any artist. What is it that compels you to do it?
I don't know. It's so ingrained. I do know that early on, one of the Super 8 films I made was, there was a short story I'd read somewhere about someone who decides to scare a guy who works in a mortuary, and they switch one of the bodies with a real person, and they tell the guy that the body is a vampire and he's going to come to life that night. And I mean, keep in mind, this is, you know, 10, 11-year-old kid shooting this. But there's a shot in it where the mortuary worker who believes his body, his dead body, is going to come to life as a vampire and doesn't realize they've switched in a live body, goes up to the body with a wooden stake and a hammer and begins to pound. And you do a cutaway to someone watching. You cut back and the stake is in the guy's heart and there's blood everywhere. And when I showed that to one of my older sisters, she screamed. And I thought, well, this is interesting. It's fun to get a reaction like that. And it is fun for that. And it's fun to you know, plant a joke in a script, and unfortunately, a year later, hear an audience react to it. It's nice to condense that a little bit whenever you can. But yeah, it's fun to just do something to make an audience go laugh or cry or be moved, or you can feel them right with the story and gasping. That's just fun. You know, I was just listening to, boy, who was it talking about two different kinds of filmmakers, and they used, I think they were talking like a Wes Anderson and Woody Allen. And we're just talking about filmmakers, not personalities here. But there are filmmakers who have ideas that they have to execute. They have to do it. And then there are filmmakers who have it on their schedule, and every October they're going to shoot a movie. And it's two entirely different mindsets of, you know, I have this great idea I want to execute, as opposed to, I've kind of got a machine going here, and, you know, I've got to feed the machine every year. But, and I've always just been more of the, I've got a great idea, I want to run with it notion.
How do you advise people to do it? What's the secret in figuring out how to do it with the resources you have or with what you can get?
Yeah, well, it took me a while to figure this out. And this works for me and won't necessarily work for everybody, but I have many filmmaker friends, and some of them, you know, are on that same sort of path. Got to raise money, got to finish film, got to get to Sundance, got to get distribution, all up and down the line. And you would read, and this is forever, you would read stories about, you know, Clerks came out of nowhere, was a hit. Slackers came out of nowhere and was a hit. And everybody was using those as the barometer. Well, you see, it can happen. And the analogy I gave was, it's like saying you've cured cancer, but you're just not counting the people who died. You're only counting the people who lived. So you never hear about, you know, there's Clerks up here, and then there's 100 other features below that year that did not get distributed and went nowhere. So yes, that model worked for Kevin Smith, although I think Kevin Smith is a lot smarter than that. The Smith Empire is not based on that one movie. But it occurred to me that since I had all the tools I needed, because I worked in corporate America and had all the video gear and lights and all the stuff that costs money, if you could take the economics out of it, if you didn't have to pay anybody, and if you didn't have to pay back anybody, which is a much bigger deal, then it can just be this thing that you go do with your friends. Not unlike, you know, I occasionally direct plays at a local theater. It's not unlike that. Nobody gets paid. They show up for 5 nights a week for 6 weeks and rehearse. And then for 3 or 4 weekends, they perform the play, and the theater keeps its doors open, and everybody has a great time. So you can do that with movies, as long as you're not trying to either pay them at the beginning or pay back people at the end. And it's the perfect time to do that now, because the biggest hurdle, which was distribution, is just kind of a speed bump now. It used to be a wall, and now it's you're pretty able to get stuff out there. If only put it on YouTube and, you know, tag it as free feature. And before you know it, you're going to have 50 views a day, and it'll go up from there. But the key is to go, all right, I'm not going to spend money that I know I'm not going to earn back. So on one of the last features I did, which was called Ghostlight, it was written for a specific location. In this case, it was the theater that I direct plays at. So we knew we had the location for free, because as it turned out, in looking at that location, we went, well, they only use the rehearsal room every night of the week, and they use the stage for 12 hours on the weekend. And generally, the building sits empty the rest of the time. So why not write something for that? So we did that, and we shot over the course of probably 9 months, just on weekends. We'd show up and shoot stuff. And I believe I spent more money entering film festivals after the fact than I did on the entire movie, because the real costs were just whatever weird props we needed, and feeding everybody, which is the biggest thing. You know, spend your money on feeding people and they'll come back next weekend. So if you can go into it with that mindset, what do I have that's not going to cost me anything? What tools can I get that aren't going to cost me anything? And the beauty now is, you know, your iPhone and a nice little Zoom recorder, you're kind of set. A few lights is nice, but if you write it properly, you can get by with very little lighting. And then you get it out there to streamers. And if it looks good and sounds good, it'll go out there. You're not going to make much. I mean, I don't know what the current rate is for streaming movies. If it's I don't know. It's very, very small that you get, but you don't need it. And that's the problem. You don't need it. And I've, you know, I find your stuff interesting because you talk about going to investors. I tried that early on and was completely turned off by it immediately because I just, I've ran into some crazy people. And when you do that to begin with, you're kind of scared of the process because they were really nutty. But also I didn't want that thing hanging over my head of, you know, I have $250,000 of this guy's money and this movie has to make it. Well, that's not a fun way to work. That's not a fun way to work at all. If you're trying to create something with a bunch of people, you don't want that thing hanging over you the whole time. And if you don't have to, then don't. Now I realize this doesn't work for everybody, that this is a minority opinion. But if you can do it, I can tell you it's a whole lot less stressful and a whole lot more fun than going the other route and dealing with raising money and trying to get that money back.
Filmmaker and author John Gaspard. Another great guest is artist Austin Young.
I want to surprise myself because I think my work is smarter than me if I just let the work find itself. Whereas like if I try to figure it out, I'm just going to like make it stupid.
You can hear my full interview with Austin in the archives at filmmakingconfidential.com or by subscribing for free to this podcast. When we come back, we'll talk with John about his film book, Fast, Cheap, and Under Control. Stay with us. I'm Steve Balderson, and this is the Filmmaking Confidential podcast. I'm back with John Gaspard.
I was in college, and I had a really good script. And we had done a couple features on video, which were getting some at least local notoriety. People were watching them. And I got a call from a woman who ran a big video production company. And she called me in and she said, I hear you have a script. Can I read it? I let her read it. And she said, I have the perfect DP for this. I think this is, you know, I always want to do a feature. Let's do this. Let's meet next week with my accountant and talk about money. So, you know, I put on a suit and I went downtown and met with her and the accountant and went over. I had done a rough budget and of course, she being in the business had done another budget. And I got home, my phone rang and it was her accountant. And he said, I know she's my client, but she's crazy. Go away. Just run away. You're not going to be happy. And I thought, wow, that's kind of scary that someone who works for her has said run away. And because I didn't need particularly when we did our 16 millimeter features and each of them cost about $30,000. I had sold some TV scripts and I had the money and I didn't have any other hobbies. And just doing it myself seemed to make more sense.
There was a fuzzy area between film and digital when it didn't quite look like film. It was still video. Was there ever a part of you that held on to film longer than others?
No. But keep in mind, I graduated from shooting features on Super 8 for single system, then double system sound, and then went into college where I had access to video equipment and video editing. And this is in the early 80s, in which there was a lot of quote unquote video art coming out. And so there were resources for video. And so we just kept shooting features on video with the understanding that, yes, it's still video, it still looks like video, but if you production design it the best you can and light it the best you can minimize that. And we never thought they would get beyond us showing them locally, and they didn't. Distributors didn't want them because they were video. And it was just a little before VHS really took off. And by the time we did the 16 millimeter features, we were right there in the middle of video and VHS. And the fact that they were on film was like, oh, hey, you have a decent movie. It's the right length. It looks okay. It sounds okay. We'll make a cover and off you go. You're on VHS. So by that time, we were on film. And we were only on video because that's what was available.
That's good. I like it when I hear anybody say that they don't let anything stop them when they're in, you know, a pursuit to create something.
Well, the only thing that stood in our way was we were editing at a facility in Minneapolis. It was designed for video as art, I guess. It had, you know, they were video artists and we were not. We were video, we were making a movie on video. And I remember one of the guys kind of yelling at me saying, "You were just using video as cheap film." And I said, "Yes. Yes, yes, we are." I don't have any other answer than, yeah, that's what we're doing because that's what's available to us. It's easier to use than Super 8. It's cheaper than Super 8, and it's available to us right now. So that's what we use for the next couple features.
That's good. I've seen, you know, I had a documentary that I did that was, it was called Phone Sex, which is now a coffee table book. And it was people calling my voicemail, answering the question, "What is sexy?" And which is funny because Penn Jillette of Penn and Teller was one of the callers. So that's just funny that he, right back into them.
It's a small world.
It is a really small world. And I had it then as a video installation in a gallery, a museum. So it was on loop. Yeah. And I would go and I would see other creations, you know, of that were like video art. Right. And it was the first time I was like, "Oh, that's really cool. I could look at that for maybe, you know, a minute and then I don't need to look at it anymore." But there were some really crazy things happening. And then I thought, you know, I wonder if you did today a feature on using video, but deliberately using it in that way, not like trying to get, you know, like an HD 4K or 2K digital camera, but you actually went back like Lynch did with whatever camera he used to do Inland Empire. And you get like an old VHS camera and you film a movie in on purpose using an old VHS camera. It could be interesting.
It could be. If assuming you can get the technology to still make it work.
Well, right. I mean, right now it's like, could you even find, like the first thing I was editing on was the video toaster.
Oh, the toaster. Goodness. Yes.
Like you couldn't even find, I mean, it's probably in a museum at this point.
Yeah. Now when we did two kind of fun features on video. We shot them on 3/4 U-matic cassettes, which are big cassettes. And they had a port-a-pack system with a 30-minute tape and then a larger deck that took an hour-long tape. And we were reusing video that the video department had used once and was throwing away. So we just grabbed the cassettes. And eventually we ran out of the smaller ones and had to go to the hour ones, which meant no matter where we went, we had to carry this 100-pound deck with us. And then all the edits were this way editing was done back there. Here's your shot, and then you put the next shot next to it, and then you put the next shot next to that. And if you needed to change something, you went back and started at the beginning and put in shot number one, and then shot number two, shot number three. And if you need to put shot number four for shot number two, you went back and you started over again, which, you know, completely linear editing. And to do two 90-minute features that way, well, we were younger and we had more stamina and more time, but it's really a slow way to make a movie.
When you were doing that, did you ask permission to film places, or did you just kind of go do it?
A little of both. Because it was video, it did require a bit more light than we would need now. So we couldn't really, unless it was something outdoors. We did a couple outdoor night scenes where the police showed up just because we were being kind of, we had people screaming because they were being stabbed in the movie. it was, you know, college stuff. And there is still a big blood stain on a wall in a sub-basement at the University of Minnesota where we didn't ask permission. But generally, yeah, you'd ask. And since they didn't really know what you were doing, they, well, yeah, sure, come on, go ahead, come on in. But it was, you know, my partner at the time who was producing with me joked that we were casting actors based on their ability to carry the gear more than their ability to act, because there was a lot of gear. And it was, if you're shooting in a, you know, third floor walk-up apartment and you've got all these lights and the camera and then this huge deck and then boxes of tape, it was sometimes a struggle.
That's hilarious. Well, when did you get the ideas? What was the genesis of your books, your film books?
Sure. I was in a screenwriting program post-college that a guy named Frank Danielle was running. Frank was one of the founders of the American Film Institute, and he came to Minnesota and taught in Northfield, Minnesota for a while, and would come into town and was running sort of weekly seminars on screenwriting. And he's, you know, he and Milos Forman were buddies, and Frank knew a lot about filmmaking and screenwriting, and sort of started a revolution sort of in the Twin Cities of people writing screenplays because he was such a good teacher. And that turned into a screenwriting group after he left. We met every week. And one of the guys in the group came up to me and said, I've got an idea for a movie. I've saved up $30,000. I took Dov Simmons' weekend course on how to make a movie for $30,000. And would you direct it for me? Because I know you know how to direct. And I said, yes, if you'll help me produce a feature after that, because I have a script as well. So we did the first movie and learned a lot and took a lot of notes, and then did the second one and learned even more. And he said, we should just write all this down, because if we do this again, we're not going to remember all this stuff that we learned. And I said, if we're going to do that, we should do a book. And it was one of those things where I just went to Barnes & Noble and looked on the shelves and who's publishing these books. And there were a couple of different ones. And one of them was Michael Wiese. And he had a lot of good books. And I just sent him a letter at that point, pre-email, and said, here's the book we're thinking of writing, which is going to be called Persistence of Vision, An Impractical Guide to Producing a Feature for Under $30,000. And he said, great, do it. And so that's what it was. We just broke down our process of how did we do it. It walked entirely through from beginning to end, even through distribution. How do you do that? And it was a very popular book. And then he said, I want to do a second edition of it, but I want to change the title to Digital Filmmaking 101. And at that point, we hadn't done any digital filmmaking. And we argued that the big point of the book was it didn't focus on technology, because technology changes all the time. And so it makes no point to have a chapter about cameras, but it's more important to have a chapter about how to break down a script, because you're always going to have to break down the script, but the cameras are going to change. But anyway, that's what he wanted to do. So the second edition was sort of cleaned up and focused a little bit on digital. And I enjoyed that process and had an idea for a third book. And my producing partner at the time wasn't that interested, but I had, because of the first two books and because of the films, I'd met a lot of filmmakers and gone to a lot of festivals and kept being asked the same questions over and over that had been answered a million years ago. People just didn't know that. And so I did a book, which is still out in print, called Fast, Cheap, and Under Control, Lessons Learned from the Greatest Low-Budget Movies of All Time. And I just took about 30 classic low-budget films and either talked to the filmmakers or assembled stuff they'd said in the past and came up with all these lessons you can learn if you just would look. You don't need to learn it yourself. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. You can understand, for example, why are rehearsals important? Well, the best example for that is when Roger Corman did Little Shop of Horrors, he paid the actors for 1 week of work. And he spent 3 of those days rehearsing and 2 of those days shooting. So rehearsing must be important, because Roger Corman doesn't pay for things he doesn't need. And then that book was pretty popular. So I did a sequel to it called Fast, Cheap, and Written That Way, in which I talked to the screenwriters who had written classic low-budget features to figure out, you know, how much are they thinking about budget when they're shooting? What other concerns are they thinking about when they're writing? Is there a big difference in writing a low-budget script as to writing another script? And all kinds of different lessons you can take away from that. And both books are still in print. And I'm surprised they sell really regularly, like several copies a day. And then a couple times a year, boom, 20 copies a day, and then another 20 copies a day. And I know it's somebody somewhere is using them as textbooks, because that's the only way you sell 20 to 30 books in a day, is if someone's using it as a textbook.
That's excellent. Tell me some of the things that are fun anecdotes or quests or tips, lessons that you can take away from.
Sure. One of my favorite ones, and I used it all the time when shooting corporate video, because with corporate video, like anything else, you have your day, and what do you need to get done in that day? And it was from Bob Odenkirk, who we all know now from Better Call Saul, but at the time he had done Mr. Show with David Cross, and he directed a feature that I saw at a film festival, I think in Michigan, called Melvin Goes to Dinner. And it was based on a four-person play called Thyroid Giants. That was a big hit, in kind of an underground hit in Los Angeles. And it's four people sitting at a restaurant dinner table drinking and talking. And that's the whole play. And it's, you know, 90 minutes long. And he figured out a way to do it with digital cameras and shooting, kind of visualizing some of the stories they're telling, in which he was able to then slip in people like Jack Black and other David Cross. So he had names in the movie. But they were in very small parts. But the thing that he said that has stuck with me to this day when I'm out shooting is, don't hesitate to hesitate. And it simply means when you got what you want shot, yes, you need to move on to the next setup, but just take a minute, look around. It's all set up. Is there anything else you can grab right now that might be helpful later? Yes, you need to race on to the next setup, but just don't hesitate to hesitate. Feel free to just take a minute. And you'd be surprised at, you know, how helpful that can be in any sort of shooting situation. Another one that I wish filmmakers would use more. A filmmaker who made a movie called Judy Berlin. He said, when you're in editing, you don't care that you have 15 takes of the same thing, because odds are you got it in the first or the second take. What you care about is, why didn't you spend that time getting different shots, give me different angles, give me other stuff? Because that's going to be much more valuable to you in the editing than having 15 takes of the same thing. And that was echoed when I talked to Edie Falco, who starred in that movie, Judy Berlin, when I told her what he had said about that. She said, yes, she finds with some directors that they think actors are this sort of endless well, that if you just keep doing it again and again, something magical is going to happen. And she said, it's not, unless there's some, you've changed something. Do you want me to do something differently? Is there an intention that's different? You're far better off just getting a different shot, getting a different angle, getting an insert shot or something. You know, there's a reason why Clint Eastwood does one take and he's on to something else. He knows what he needs and he gets it and he goes on. And endless takes of the same thing over and over, particularly in our low budget world, are just, it's just feeding your ego and it's not helping your movie.
Well, I've always said casting. I mean, everybody says this, casting is key. If you have cast correctly, you don't really have to do very much else. You
know, that's absolutely true. When I talked to Steven Soderbergh about Sex, Lies, and Videotape, one of the things he said emphatically was, you have to be open on casting. He said, Andy McDowell was not at all what he had pictured, was nowhere near what he wanted, and walked in and blew him away. And if he had been resistant and just looked at the headshot and gone, no, we're not even bothered talking to her, he wouldn't have gotten that performance in that film. And it can be tricky. I know when we did our first 60 millimeter feature, it was essentially a three-person movie. We're very lucky in the Twin Cities because we have a strong film community and a strong theater community. So we have a lot of good actors. We are people who make their living as actors and live in the Twin Cities. So we had great auditions for the movie. And the lead part, the lead male, at the end of the day, at the end of auditions, I said to the producer, okay, well, saw some great people today. Here's two that I think stood out. And both of them are still making a living as actors. And he said, yeah, but neither one of them looks like what I pictured. I said, yeah, that's true. But that person's they're not going to show up. These are both really strong actors. And if you notice, you know, could take direction at it and came in with ideas. And being able to just get that thing out of your mind, that's not what I pictured, when you're in casting can save your life, because you're going to, someone will come in and just completely amaze you if you're open to it. There's a story in Fast, Cheap, and Under Control from the guy who made the movie Carnival of Souls, which I had not seen before I did that book, and someone turned me on to Carnival of Souls, and it pops up all the time now. But he talked about the lead actress was cast by his producer. His producer went to New York and saw her in a play and said she'd be perfect. And he went and he picked her up at the airport, and he was devastated. He said, this isn't going to work. I don't know what to do. And he brought her to the hotel and picked her up the next morning and started shooting. He thought, well, I I can't fire her. We'll just see if we can make it work. And then she walked onto the set and became the character that he had written. She just wasn't that in real life. And he couldn't see that until she started doing it. And people, you know, it's sort of the flip side of typecasting. You know, you think they can only do that one thing and are surprised when they do something else. And when you've got someone who isn't what you thought, and then just give them a second, they're an actor. Give them a second. It's probably in there. You just haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, that's great. Tell me your definition of, because people throw around no budget, low budget, you know, all sorts of different budgets. How do you define low budget?
Well, it certainly can't be we have less money than we'd like to have, because that's always the case. I don't know if you can anymore. I really don't know, because you can effectively make a no-budget movie now that's 4K and beautiful, and it didn't cost you anything. So I don't know. I don't know if you can define it anymore.
In my new movie, Xander Berkeley plays the lead, and his wife, Sarah Clark, is opposite him. And I remember one of their managers was like, "What's your budget? What's your budget?" And I said, "If I told you the truth, you would never believe that this movie is going to look like it looks." And it's out now on the festival circuit. So I'm excited about that. But, and sometimes I've deliberately shown a movie of mine to someone and said, "How much do you think that we spent on this?" And they'd say, "Oh, I don't know, what, $1 million? And I'd say, "Ha," you know, like, not even close. And then I always say, "Okay, take your budget. You know, here's your budget, 100% of your budget. Let's just say that's $500,000. Well, you may only have to spend $30,000 cash, but, you know, there's all this other stuff that's the equivalent of what you would spend money on. But let's say you got your housing donated, there are meals donated, you have actors who are willing to work for deferred payment or nothing or points, or you've got, you know, free equipment, you've got your own gear, you know, all those have a value."
Yep.
So that value should be included as what your budget costs, because someone who doesn't have those things would otherwise have to rent them.
Exactly. Yep.
But it doesn't have to be cash.
Yeah, people don't. When our feature Beyond Bob was being shopped around to distributors, that was always the first question: what did it cost? And we'd say, "What do you think it cost?" And they say, "Oh, it probably cost about $500,000." We go, "Okay, it didn't. It cost $30,000, but yeah, okay, sure, $500,000. If that's what you think, that, what does it matter?" It's exactly. It's like when people were upset when Ishtar came out and how much money it cost. And Warren Beatty said, "Doesn't change the ticket price. Still $8 to get in, whether it costs $40 million or $10 million. Doesn't really matter. Why do you care?" And I think, you know, unless you're trying to raise the money, the budget is sort of, I think too much emphasis is placed on what did a movie cost.
When someone says, "Oh, I need to raise, you know, whatever it is to make my movie," I say, "How much do you think you're going to sell it for?" You know, and I'm like, "Do you think you're going to sell it for $2 million? Do you think you're going to get $2 million for this?" And if they say yes, and really are, you know, have thought it through, I'm like, "Okay, power to you. Good luck. And hopefully that happens for you." But
yeah, but a lot of times it's because I heard that somebody sold something at Sundance for $2 million, and therefore that's what things go for. It's like, well, no, you're just hearing the publicity, and look at all the movies that were at Sundance that year that nobody bought.
What's next for you?
Well, the 8th book in the Eli Mark series is coming out, and we'll start the audiobook for that, which is fun. And we'll do season 2 of the podcast, Behind the Page, the Eli Marks podcast, in which people can hear the whole of book 2 as part of the podcast. And then I'm not sure. I just did an animatic of one of the short stories, which is fun to kind of dip back into production that way. I was working with an artist out of Venezuela who drew it as a comic book for me. And as I was looking at it, I thought, well, this is, you know, it's not animation, but it's an animatic. It's close. And I already had it narrated. So I went ahead and just made an animatic out of that. And that was fun. It's been a while since I dipped my toes into production. The big thing I'm working on right now is our feature Beyond Bob, which was shot in 1991 and is 30 years old. I just had it rescanned from the original negative So we have a nice new 2K print of it. Well, not a print, but a video of it. We'll be releasing that. It's interesting, and I'm sure you've run into this, or if you haven't, you're going to as you get older. People forget that when you make a movie, a couple things happen. One, somebody has to be responsible for that movie for forever. Someone has to, you know, keep track of what's going on with that movie. And as my partner at the time said when we were shooting it, because we did the shot on a 16, edited the negative, then took the negative and did, went right to video from the negative and did all the color correction that way. So we walked out of there with state-of-the-art 1-inch Video Master, which was state-of-the-art at the time. 30 years later, just try to find somebody who can play back a 1-inch, and you realize that once you produce a movie, not only do you need to take care of it like a dog for the rest of your life, but you need to keep moving it into the new technologies as they come about. And you might think, well, no, I think we've kind of settled on technology. I'm like, no, it keeps changing all the time. And it's your responsibility as a producer to either keep your product up to date with that or realize that it's just going to get lost and it's going to go away. Things change very quickly. And people lament how the studios have handled features over the years and not preserving them and such. Independent producers are going to be stuck in that same quandary of my movie is, you know, three generations back from what's state of the art now, and I can't get it because the steps in between are now gone. That's that piece of advice, which is you're going to have this movie for a long time and be prepared. And you might even want to put money aside to keep updating it so that it can live in the different formats. My biggest thing that I like to just, and I've kind of already said it, is if you can take the economics out of filmmaking, you're going to be so much happier. Will your movie be on Netflix? Probably not. But will you be like filmmakers I talked to when I did the first book, remortgaging your house or losing your house or ruining your credit rating back in the day when everyone thought it was such a great idea to put movies on credit cards without really realizing that smart people weren't doing that and that it was hype. If you can just think about it the word hobby has bad connotations to it, but it doesn't have to make money. And if you can set it up so it doesn't have to make money, you can enjoy the process a whole lot more.
Filmmaker and author John Gaspard. Tune in next time for more Filmmaking Confidential. It is totally free to subscribe. And when you subscribe, you'll get upcoming new episodes automatically. And you'll have free access to all our past shows. The Filmmaking Confidential podcast is a production of Dakanga Audio and produced by myself and Ella Spencer. Our original theme music is composed by Kevin Robles. For more of the Filmmaking Confidential podcast, head over to filmmakingconfidential.com. If you have a question about filmmaking you'd like me to answer on the podcast, send me an email using the contact form on the website. To learn more of my filmmaking secrets, be sure to pick up a copy of the book, Filmmaking Confidential, available on Audible, paperback, and ebook, wherever books are sold. I'm Steve Balderson. Thanks for listening and spreading the word. Until next time, keep making, keep doing, keep going.